I've been fortunate to interview some of the most interesting people in the world of medicine, but there's only one person who has been interviewed twice as of tonight, and that's it, because he's the most interesting, I believe, the most talented writer in medicine of our era. And tonight we're going to talk about his second book, The Laws of Medicine, and we'll also touch on, I think, what will be his third book coming out next spring a little bit, too. So let's get into this book. Uh-huh. It's a really interesting, it's a short read, not a like the opus of The Emperor of All Maladies.
Right.
And let's maybe get started. What was the trigger, what was the stimulus for you to do The Laws of Medicine?
So first of all, thank you for having me. I enjoy these conversations with you. They're just like fireside chats for me. But The Laws of Medicine began actually as a very simple project. It began not as a book. And I think the best books begin not as books. It began because when I was a young resident, I had read a book that actually was simultaneously very funny but very acerbic at the same time, the famous House of God. How many people have read House of God? It's a very strikingly important book. And Samuel Shem, who wrote The House of God, wrote down these laws when he published The House of God, and they were very acerbic laws. One of the laws, just to remind you, is law 10 is, if the radiology resident and the intern both see a lesion on an x-ray, that means that the lesion doesn't exist. That was law 10.
One of them was Gomer, get out of my emergency room, and all kinds of stuff like
and
that.
And then another important law was which I actually always remind myself. It says law 3 or law 4, I may be misquoting here, is the patient is the one with the problem. Actually, that's a very important thing to remember in medicine, because you always often forget. You think that it's your problem as a physician, but in fact, it's the patient who has the problem. So this is, and I don't mean these remarks as humorous. I think we take them very deeply.
Very acerbic.
They're very, very acerbic, but they were very important because they framed a way of thinking around medicine, and I wanted to find a frame. So this was, to be very clear about the project, we were talking about this a little bit before, I didn't want to make capital L laws or commandments. I wanted some direction for myself as I navigated a field that was fundamentally uncertain, that was fundamentally full of things that I didn't understand. And I wanted to ask the question, how do we imagine what principles hold for the future? And the framework that I used, and that's important here, was, you know, colloquially, we hear all this stuff about medicine, the science of medicine. If that's true, if there's a science of medicine, then sciences have laws. Physics has laws. Chemistry has laws. Biology has laws. And the simple question was, if that's the case, then what are the laws of medicine? And again, to emphasize, these were not meant to be sort of universal commandments. These were meant to be explorations about principles that might hold true about medicine today, and particularly that might hold true about medicine in the future. That was the framework for this book.
We're going to talk about those three laws. But before we get into that, it seems that the book was very much inspired by Lewis Thomas.
Yes.
And I think you can tell us a little bit more about Lewis Thomas. Perhaps you even met him before.
I never met Lewis Thomas, but I was very inspired by his book, yeah.
So he had a book that was The Youngest Science.
Yeah.
So that seemed to be setting the tone a bit?
Absolutely. And you know, even the title is echoed in this book. So Lewis Thomas, as many of you know, worked in New York. He was at NYU and then subsequently at Memorial Sloan Kettering. He was the head of Memorial Sloan Kettering. And Lewis Thomas was a very influential figure for me and for many, many young physicians. And he wrote some incredibly important books among them, The Lives of a Cell. But the book that I thought was very interesting particularly was a book that I was inspired by, which was called The Youngest Science, in which Lew Thomas made the claim that medicine is the youngest science. And Lew Thomas sort of trained in the 1930s and 1940s, began to practice medicine in the 1950s, and he experienced an absolute transformation of medicine, in medicine. So Thomas's setup, you know, Thomas came from a time when medicine was observational in the 1930s. Basically, what happened is that if you had a heart attack in the 1930s and you had congestive heart failure following that, what doctors would do is they would admit you to the hospital, and they had four or five interventions they could do. They could put you in an oxygen tent, they give you oxygen. When you had severe volume overload, they could take a needle and take out several cc's of blood and throw the blood away. And that was the way that it would cure volume overload. And in the worst case scenario, I mean, they used all sorts of things to try and diurese you a little bit. There were rumors that they make you drink coffee to try to diurese. Yeah.
You alluded to the three P's, I guess, placebo,
right.
Palliative, and plumbing.
Yes, that's right.
And there was a therapeutic nihilism.
That's right. So there was Thomas described this as therapeutic nihilism because he said, you know, doctors had nothing to do. But as I point out in the book, therapeutic nihilism in medicine was extremely important because it was like taking an eraser and saying, the past is the past. It didn't work. All of that stuff was nonsense. It didn't work. Let's really observe a patient and do nothing. So I say that, you know, the dictum, the Hippocratic Oath, was transformed into from first do no harm to first do nothing. And just look. And in Thomas's time in the 1930s, for a time, people like Osler at Hopkins decided that what they would do is they would erase the past and they would do nothing. They would just observe. What happens? What is the natural history of disease? And what was interesting is that it was so contaminated, that idea was so contaminated with nonsensical interventions, half of which didn't work, there were no trials, that just doing nothing was like a cleansing. And they did nothing and they observed. What happens when the heart fails? What are the sequelae? What are the sequelae that happen in heart? What happens when you get a pneumonia, when you get a bacterial pneumonia? And what is the natural history of the bacterial pneumonia? So Thomas watched therapeutic nihilism first cleanse the discipline of medicine, and then he watched the first great reasoned scientific medical interventions enter the world. He gives a beautiful example. He says, you know, in his time, if you had a streptococcal infection, what would happen is the first thing that would happen is you would be admitted to the hospital, and the intern's job was to type the streptococcal infection that you had based on the agglutinin reaction. So they would draw them. Can you imagine this? They would send it off to some pathology lab. Your job at night, that night, because if you failed to do it that night, the patient would be dead the next morning. So your job that night was to identify what the subtype, the antigenic subtype of the streptococcus was, and if you couldn't do it correctly, you would have a dead human being who could be a 30-year-old man who'd gotten an incidental streptococcal infection, and you would spend the entire night figuring out what the agglutinin reaction was, what antibody would cross-react with, so that by the next morning, you could transfuse that patient with the convalescent serum, antibodies basically, from another patient who had had that same subtype of streptococcal infection. Imagine this as a physician, right? So you were the intern. Your job to save the patient was to find out that reaction so that the next morning, you could inject that person. And if you got the answer right, the person would become cured. They would rise up the next morning from their literal deathbed. I mean, it was a lethal infection, you know, streptococcal pneumonia, with an empyema, or they would wake up from a lethal reaction. They would have a brisk immunological reaction. They would clear the bacteria and they would rise up from the dead. And Thomas watched this happen first with infectious diseases. He began to watch some of this happen with cardiology, with cardiac diseases. All of a sudden, you were not just doing, putting the person in an oxygen tent, but you were actually starting to give real diuretics, antiarrhythmics, all these new medicines that had come up. And then finally, he started watching that in cancer. You'd start getting chemotherapy, you'd get into remission. And he said, well, there is the beginning of a science in here. There's a scientific, we're starting from reason, from first principles, identifying pathophysiology, and then going from pathophysiology into therapeutics.
Well, this is what I love about your writing is that you take the lessons from history. They're rich, which are often either neglected or just not known. And then you integrate that with your own clinical experience with patients, which you do in this book quite a bit. And so now I don't want to get into these three laws.
Sure.
And we'll go as laws. The first one about priors.
Yes.
A strong intuition is much more powerful than a weak test. Tell us about that.
So, you know, I was inspired, and the book is actually dedicated to Bayes, Thomas Bayes. And I was mesmerized by the idea that a 17th century or 18th century cleric working by himself in basically a church could figure out the idea that prior probability dictates posterior probability. and how applicable this has become to medicine today. So it turned out, of course, that Lewis Thomas had reached a point in which he had said, look, you know, we've got all these new tests. The tests will be matched with medicines, and once the tests and the medicines are matched, we're going to solve the medical problem. You know, this is going to be the science of medicine. You're going to come in. We're talking about precision medicine all the time. Right? So you're going to come in. You're going to get a test. The test will match. You will understand. Help us understand the disease. We will understand the pathophysiology. That will be matched to a medicine. You'll get the medicine. You'll go home happy. Everyone is. That's the end of the story. But in reality, of course, medicine has not worked out so simply. And one thing that's not worked out simply is that no test, as we found out, is a pure test. Tests have false negatives, they have false positives, and that's an intrinsic feature of testing. It's a deep feature or intrinsic feature of testing that whether you measure a PSA on someone or measure whether someone has a BRCA1 mutation, very hard test, BRCA1 mutation, strong test, right? Even so, we are not able to predict with definite virtue or with 100% certainty whether a woman with BRCA1 mutation will develop breast cancer or not. We can't predict, obviously, if you have a high PSA level, whether you have prostate cancer and whether your prostate cancer is the aggressive or the non-aggressive indolent type. So the first idea that I wanted to convey in the book is that the only way that we learn how to use tests is by using prior knowledge. And the example I use is a very simple example, which is you go to a street fair, and it's actually an example that actually even Bay is understood. You go to a street fair, and someone is tossing coins, and the coin lands heads, and the first time, the head lands heads against the second time, third time, fourth time, fifth time, and you ask a pure statistician, you know, what is the chance that it's going to land heads the next time? And the pure statistician says 50-50. But if you ask a child, they'll say, stupid, the coin is rigged, right? That's why it's landing heads all the time. The child knows more than the pure statistician because the child understands that prior probability dictates posterior probabilities. And that idea has been so difficult for even doctors to understand in medicine that all of the stuff that we're doing, which seems so hyper-complicated, genomic sequencing, epigenomic sequencing, you know, complex family history mapping, et cetera, all we're really trying to do is trying to take tests and switch their prior probability. That's the real message that we're trying to understand.
Well, and getting this rich context.
Getting the rich context.
That really leads to a much better interpretability of some new data, right?
Absolutely. And we cannot interpret the new data without the context. That's why medicine exists.
Yeah.
Medicine exists because, and one of the things that I conclude is that medicine exists because you need that prior context. You know, when you come as a patient to a physician's office, one of the first things that they're trying to do is get in contact. That's why the medical data sheet begins with history. Begins with history, not test.
Right.
It begins with history and physical, not test and physical, or, you know, conclusion and physical. And that's the first law. It's really a Bayesian idea.
I'm with you. And yep. I think that's great for those who are not into Bayesian principles. They'll get this really very well from the laws of medicine. Now, second, about outliers. And I also want you to tell us about inliers, because I like that term. Normals teach us rules. Outliers teach us laws.
So this second idea grew out of my own experience. And again, I'll begin with a simple analogy, which is that if you think a lot about, you know, what's happening in medicine today is we've solved quite effectively what I call the inlier problem. And the inlier is a word I made up. But the inlier problem is that we have a relatively simple idea or relatively well-demarcated idea of what the normal range of physiology is. So there's a normal range of blood pressure. There's a normal range of height, weight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's based on large studies, based on population studies usually to figure those out. But once in a while, we have people who lie outside that. So there are people, for instance, who have very high blood pressure, who've never had a stroke, who've never had a heart attack, right? And in the past, that was dismissed as coincidence. And surely some of that is coincidence. Some of that is because of random effects in time. This is like the person who comes and says, I smoked all my life and didn't get lung cancer, therefore cigarettes cannot possibly cause lung cancer. And you can say, well, that's obviously not true because we know large pieces of data. But The converse is very interesting, which is to ask the question, why is it that some people who have had long histories of smoking don't have lung cancer? Some of that, some fraction of that is clearly because of chance, but some fraction of that is not because of chance. And when you identify those people, you're going to begin to get new insights into the pathophysiology of cancer. You could say the same thing about heart disease. You could say the same thing about strokes. The point about the second law is to say that, you know, we have spent a lot of time creating this understanding the inlier problem. But what's really interesting is to find the outliers and figure out what they tell us about the deeper structure of the pathophysiology of a disease.
Like the exceptional responder in cancer.
Like the exceptional responder. And I use the exceptional responder as one example. Now, cancer is a highly genetic disease. You know, obviously there are environmental carcinogens that trigger genetic events. So the exceptional responder problem, many of you know this quite well, is that, you know, for the longest time, we spent a lot of time in cancer biology and clinical trials saying, who's the typical responder? And that has very helpful because that tells you, you know, who responds to precision medicine, who responds to tamoxifen, who responds to some combination of drugs. But now, with all these new tools that we have, we can begin to answer the question, who responds, who does not respond to the standard therapies and who responds to some exceptional therapies? And I think those are very interesting because they point to deeper principles of pathophysiology, deeper principles of medicine, which I think are brought out by these exceptional responders.
Oh, that's great. Now, the third and final one is about bias. And for every perfect medical experiment, there is a perfect human bias. What do you mean by that?
And the third law really was inspired by an idea that I had had while I was practicing medicine, really learning medicine as a resident, which is that I was inspired by another book, a very important book called The Microbe Hunters. Many of you may have known this book. It's Paul LeCroix's book. If you ask most of the major scientific minds of today and medical minds of today, what one of the books, one of the common books that inspired them, they point to two books, actually. Lou Thomas's book, Youngest Science or Lives of a Cell, and then Paul LeCroix's book about microbe hunters, in which he described the birth of microbiology, how and infectious diseases. And I thought to myself, well, if the doctors of the 1950s or 1930s were microbe hunters or cause hunters, what are we doing today? What are we doing today when we look at all these clinical trials? And I realized that what we're really, one of the things that we're doing today, not the only thing, but one of the things that we're doing today is we're hunting bias. Because there is so much information that comes to us. The information comes to us from clinical trials, and the popular press is full of this information. You get 1,000 pieces of information from the popular press and information from clinical trials. But what we have to do as physicians is to figure out how to think about those trials in a critical way and be skeptical about them and to say, look, that's an important piece of information, but let me tell you what the bias in that information was so that I can now take the larger body of information and apply it to a single human being, to a single patient. So just to give you one example, a large randomized trial is run on patients and clearly shows that some intervention, tamoxifen, works extremely well for preventing breast cancer in high-risk populations. 10 days later, you have an African-American woman who comes to your clinic, has a high risk, meets the profile criteria, and says, should I take tamoxifen? Let me just tell you that I took it for 2 months and had a terrible reaction to it. I really don't want to do it. It really made my life miserable. I had terrible side effects. But if you think it's useful, I'll do it. Now, a stupid thing to say is to say, here's the trial. It says, you know, women who take this drug have a benefit. You're a woman. Let me give you the drug. The much more interesting, much more important way is to now integrate all this information and say, well, wait a second, that trial was run on white women in Kansas. And what are the chances? What is the chances that that randomized trial, it's a powerful trial, that randomized trial, very, very focused trial, is going to apply to you, who's maybe 36-year-old, was not in that initial group, have a different racial and genetic background, and what are the chances that's going to apply to you? So our job right now is to interpret data, very complex pieces of data, some randomized, some non-randomized, some pieces of information, and now incorporate all this into the treatment of one single individual who's sitting in your office and really needs help. So that's basically the third piece of information.
And you kind of put these together, priors, outliers, biases, kind of the laws of imperfection in medicine. But there's many implications of your thoughts and writing here. One I want to get into is about medical education and selecting doctors, because as you point out, there's this profusion of data that is not necessarily, this knowledge is not wisdom. Should we be selecting different types of people to be the doctors of the future based on some of these points?
I'm not sure about it. Who we select or don't select is not really the interesting thing to me. What's interesting to me is how we train the people that we do select. So once you've selected the people, how do you allow individuals, physicians in training, to be able to deal with fundamentally imperfect information? That is, I think, the science of medicine. If the science of medicine is telling us one thing, it is that uncertainty, imperfections, priors, outliers, and biases are endemic. They are not going to go away. They're not going to go away today. They're not going to go away tomorrow. They're not going to go away 50 years from now, 100 years from now.
We're going to talk about that.
Right. So that idea, that the sooner we instill in ourselves and the sooner we instill in our students, the sooner we instill in our patients, we will have, I think, ultimately a much more collaborative effort to solving the major problems of human disease. It's amazing that even in 2015, we're trying to struggle with that idea. How do you use real information to get at the most important and beautiful information that exists, truths?
No question. Now, there are some very important issues that we face today that suggest how bad things are still in 2015. Let me just rattle a few off.
Yeah.
One, that we have 12 million serious diagnostic medical errors a year, and that is unchanged, as best we know, since Ter-Er is human, 1999. Now it seems like without any change, it's and this continues, it's actually become inhumane. Now have all these errors. But we have in the top 20 drugs that are prescribed by sales, at least, we have 80% are actually non-responders.
Yes.
So we give these drugs. We have all this hope, as you point out in the book. But oftentimes, in fact, in the plurality of patients, they actually don't respond.
Yes.
Then we have the issue of false positives in screening, like
huge
mammography, PSA, greater than 60%.
Yes.
False positive, yet they are done, tests that are done widely in millions of people every year. And the list goes on about all the problems we have now. The sense I got from the book was that you don't think we can change this too much. We have to live with this.
Well, the sense that I have from writing the book is the following, which is that it's not that we're going to live with it, but we have to refine it. Which is to say that there is no, to ask the question whether, if you have a PSA test and it's positive, to ask the question whether you have prostate cancer or don't have prostate cancer is a stupid question, right? So the question to ask at that stage is, what are the risk factors? What do we know? Who are the outliers? So in other words, how do we modify knowledge so that we get to, again, going back to Thomas Bayes' example, Bayesian analysis example, how do you go from concrete test knowledge to truth? The book is a plea for all of these changes in context, which is to say that we have a rich opportunity today to integrate extraordinarily deep medical context into the information system of a human being. I still think that we will have perceptual biases. That's not going to change.
That's hard to get over that.
I still think that there will be outlier and inlier problems.
Yes.
And I still think that it will be imperfect tests. But we have the opportunity to now integrate all of this unbelievable information and make a real difference in medical care.
Okay. Now, I don't know if I trapped you, but I'm getting you to a point where you're not big on big data. But the final two sentences of the book, you quote Malcolm Gladwell about the political revolution will not be tweeted. And your final sentence, well, the medical revolution will not be algorithmized. Now, with that statement, the problem I see is that you have enormous amount of data coming in each person to have this context that we never had before. That's, quote, precision medicine, if you will, or individualized medicine. And you can't, no human being can process that data, mm-hmm. right? Right? You would agree?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
So don't you think algorithms and computing power, machine learning, artificial intelligence will have a place to get us over some of this imperfection?
No, so I agree with that. I mean, look, I've stated this before. I don't have a problem with big data. I don't believe or disbelieve in big data. Big data exists. You can get it. You know, whether I say I believe or disbelieve in big data is not relevant. What's relevant is, are we using intelligence to interpret big data? And it is, and I think that there is a seduction of big data where you know, lack of intelligence can show. I'll give you the classic, a historical example, is the great argument between Galton and Mendel. Okay? So, and this kind of brings me to the new book. So, Galton was a classic big data man, right? So he measured, he went around the world, and he said, what do noses, what do the shape of or sizes of noses look like? And he plotted a smooth curve between the size of noses, and it looked like a big bell-shaped curve. He went and said, well, what does intelligence look like? So he measured IQ, and sure enough, it's a bell-shaped curve. You know, what is the structure of, what color of skin look like? Bell-shaped curve, et cetera, et cetera. And if you take all of this information, you would think that human heredity is moved from human beings to human beings through bell-shaped curves. I would trade a bell-shaped curve. And it took a monk who had no experience in any statistics, for the most part, had trained, you know, who crossed two P's, the smallest of small data, who crossed two P's and found that, in fact, things really don't behave that way. Yeah. You cross a short plant and a tall plant, you don't get a bell-shaped curve, you get a short plant. It's very discrete. You cross a yellow pea and a green pea, and you don't get an intermediate color pea. You get only one pea. So the point is that there's a seduction of big data without smart interventions, smart interpretations of data, which I think can be very seductive. So I have no problem with big data. My problem is that if you don't use intelligence to interpret big data, then that big data produces nonsense. Right. It produces more big data.
That's great.
And the job of big data is not to produce more big data. It is to produce wisdom and knowledge and truths.
Well, I like that. It's the real intelligence, not the artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And I think you've clarified that.
Yeah.
That's great. I know your next book is going to be out next May or June or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's called The Gene.
Yeah.
And you want to just tell us a little bit about that? You gave us a bit of an...
I talked a little bit about it. I'm happy to, you know, now the book is complete. It's finished. It's a much deeper, bigger book in terms of you could throw it at someone and kill them. But
it's even bigger than
Emperor of All Maladies, right? I should say. It's bigger, but I hope that it reads with the same kind of intensity and people fall into it. It opens a universe, and the book is about what happens once we learn to read and write the human genome. So we, as you know, in your laboratory, as you know, in our own practice, in our laboratory, we are now reading genomes, for instance, for cancer and for other diseases, in a way that we couldn't do before. And we are writing genomes, we're editing and changing genomes with a facility that we couldn't do before. And so the question is, now that those tools become available and we now know how deeply the genome is linked to human identity, what happens once we begin to change it? And that's the question of the book. It starts from Mendel and goes into the future.
Yeah. Let me just say, this has been really stimulating. Yeah, the book is great. It's a short read, but it's an impactful read. And also, we're looking forward to the next biggie on the gene, because that's obviously going to be a highly impactful book. But the way you're able to juggle being a researcher, still being a medical oncologist, and an author, I don't know how you do it. So maybe you can give us the answers so that we all can try to emulate you.
Well, I don't have an answer. I just
Well, we are big fans. I think everyone here tonight just came here because they wanted to
get
your perspective and hear some of your thinking, which it's probably hard to articulate in words any better than you can. I think if Lewis Thomas was here to be able to read this book that in some ways has a parallels to The Youngest Science, he would say you've done an extraordinary job.
I would be so honored.
Thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you.